This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello, welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Peter Clote, and here's what's coming up.
You want to stabilize the east of the DRC, you need to put about 20,000 troops in there with lots of air support. You need to stay there for 10 years.
That's independent African defense analyst Helmoid Heitman saying he doesn't see the AU succeeding in bringing peace to the eastern DRC unless it throws a lot of resources into a peacekeeping effort. Also, the African Union's Heads of State Summit begins in Addis Ababa tomorrow. And officials in Russia say opposition leader Alexei Navalny died in prison today. All this and more coming up on African News Tonight. Senegal's Constitutional Council on Thursday ruled that Parliament's unprecedented postponement of the February 25th presidential vote was not in line with the Constitution, pitching the country into a new phase of electoral uncertainty. Opposition presidential candidates and lawmakers last week filed several legal challenges to the bill that delayed the vote until December and extended President Macky Sall's mandate in what critics said amounted to an institutional coup. The standoff has fueled widespread unrest and raised international concerns that one of the remaining democracies in coup-hit West Africa is under threat. For reaction, I reach reporter Alpha Jallo in the Senegalese capital, Dakar.
The Constitutional Court also indicated that the election cannot be held in this month, on the 25th of February, as initially scheduled. The Constitutional Court said that the options is now left for President Macky Sall. The Constitutional Court said that President Macky Sall should organize election as soon as possible. It should be within now to the 2nd of April, the time when President Macky Sall's mandate is over.
What are the president's options now?
That's a very good question, rather. The president now, he has only two options. That is to organize the election as soon as possible, or if he cannot organize the election until the expiry of his mandate, that is the 2nd of April, he will resign and hand over power to the President of the National Assembly, who will then organize the elections within 90 days, according to the constitution of this country. Those are the only two options President Macky Sall got now.
Two former Senegalese heads of state have called on the political leaders to engage in dialogue in an effort to resolve what they term the political crisis. Do you see any signs that such a dialogue can start soon?
Yes, obviously, because according to how things are unfolding yesterday and today, some of the reactions that are coming from the president's camp, you realize that President Macky Sall is open to dialogue. And the other important thing is that yesterday, most of these political detainees, dozens of them, are released from detention. And that's a sign that President Macky Sall is open to dialogue, because he was saying that some of the main obstacles for having dialogue, or the main stumbling block for having dialogue with these politicians, some of them were calling, "You cannot call us for dialogue when you are holding some of our party supporters or party militants, when you are holding about more than 1,000 political detainees languishing in various prisons across the country." So we have realized that yesterday, dozens of them, some of them even high profile, party sympathizers, they were released yesterday from jail. So it is clear that if things are looking at things from this, you will see that President Macky Sall is ready to have dialogue with with his opponent, especially the entire political class.
What has been the overall reaction of the people of Senegal following the ruling by the Constitutional Court?
Yes, some of them are very happy. Some of the politicians, they said that Senegal is now trying to going back to the trajectory, democratic trajectory that the country has been known for so many years. Especially the former Prime Minister, Aminata Touré, he said something like that. And he said that also, she said that this will show that, there is a complete, separation of powers. because if the Constitutional Court could rule against the president, and the president is the person who appointed the serving magistrate at the Constitutional Court, so this is a clear indication that the separation of powers in this country is highly respected. All the reactions are also coming that President Macky Sall, when he was doing this, according to some of the reactions, he knew that he cannot get the support of the Constitutional Court because Senegal has been known, I mean, for its democracy and its rule of law and good governance.
That was reporter Alpha Jallo speaking from Dakar with me. The African Union Summit of Heads of State begins in Addis Ababa tomorrow, but before that, leaders are meeting today to focus on violence in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. Rebel groups have been fighting DRC government forces since the mid-1990s for a variety of reasons, including control over the region's vast mineral wealth. Darren Taylor reports.
South Africa's Minister of International Relations, Naledi Pandor, told journalists in Johannesburg that Angola's President João Lourenço is convening the special mini-summit on the violence in Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo. More than 100 rebel groups have been fighting in the region for nearly three decades. Of particular concern now is the M23, one of the largest militias. The DRC government accuses Rwanda of supporting the M23, which Rwanda denies. The M23 formed in 2012, saying it was protecting ethnic Tutsis in the DRC from Hutu militias, but human rights groups say the rebels have committed widespread atrocities. Pandor says the meeting's objective is to avoid an all-out war between DRC and Rwanda.
So it's been a point of tension for some time, and there are allegations that Rwanda may very well be involved with some of the groups that are in armed conflict with the DRC armed forces. So certainly President Lourenço, who's been mediating and trying to draw the different parties together and even to speak to some of these rebel or armed groups, will be providing a report. And from what I've seen on the program, it would appear that both the DRC president and that of Rwanda would be in attendance.
Pandor says Presidents Felix Tshisekedi and Paul Kagame will update the African Union about efforts being made to reach peace. The heads of government of AU member countries are gathering in Addis Ababa for their annual summit on Saturday and Sunday. The top diplomats of the member states have been meeting this week ahead of the summit. Pandor says the AU also expects the Kigali government to elaborate on its alleged role in the fighting.
On the matter of the involvement of Rwanda or the alleged entry of Rwandan forces into the DRC and a possible negative role, there is a UN report that suggests that some of these allegations may be true, but it couldn't pinpoint the involvement of the government, but certainly elements from Rwanda being involved in the conflict that is underway in the eastern DRC.
Despite Rwanda's denials, United Nations investigators and the European Union and United States have said there's evidence Kigali has supported the rebels. Independent African defense analyst Helmut Heitmann tells VOA, with the UN unable to keep the peace in the region, he doesn't see the AU succeeding unless it throws a lot of resources into a peacekeeping effort.
You want to stabilize the east of the DRC, you need to put about 20,000 troops in there with lots of air support. You need to stay there for 10 years. UN was there for 20 years, but the force was too weak. It had very little air support. It didn't have heavy weapons. It had fairly tight rules of engagement and just achieved nothing. Bear in mind, it's not just M23, it's all those other irregular forces. They are Burundi guerrilla groups. Some of these, like the ADF, have been living in the east of the DRC for more than 20 years. They have intermarried locally, they're now part of the local furniture.
So says Heitmann, that means ending the various conflicts in eastern DRC cannot be achieved simply by driving the rebels into other countries. He says the region's arguably the most complex war zone in the world, and as such, any peace effort will have to match that complexity. An M23 offensive in recent weeks has pushed thousands of people to flee their homes around the city of Sake in North Kivu province. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
Prison officials in Russia say opposition leader Alexei Navalny is dead. The official statement has not been independently confirmed. Russian media quoted officials of the Federal Prison Service as saying the 47-year-old Navalny, a fierce opponent of President Vladimir Putin, died today in central Russia after falling ill during a walk. They say medical staff were called but could not resuscitate him. Officials say an investigation has been launched to determine the cause of death. Navalny was serving a 19-year sentence on charges of extremism. He was moved from his former prison in the Vladimir region of central Russia to a maximum security penal colony in the town of Kharp in the Yamalo-Nenets region, some 1,900 kilometers northeast of Moscow. You are listening to Africa News Tonight. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. For more information on these and other stories from the continent, please see voaafrica.com. There you will find all your favorite VOA radio and TV programs and a whole lot more. For world news, check out voanews.com. Senior United Nations officials on Thursday highlighted deteriorating security conditions in West Africa linked to the growing entrenchment of the Islamic State extremist group and its affiliate. UN Undersecretary General for Counterterrorism Vladimir Voronkov told the Security Council that despite progress in combating the group, it continues to pose a serious threat to international peace and security, particularly in the most affected regions of West Africa and the Sahel. According to the French news agency AFP, he said the situation in the region has deteriorated in the past 6 months and is becoming increasingly more complex, with local, ethnic and regional disputes operating with more autonomy than the core of the Islamic State. Voronkov, referring to a new UN report this week, said if these autonomous trends continue, a vast area of instability may emerge from Mali to the borders of Nigeria. In Mozambique, young people aspire to pursue formal education and secure a job, but they say that entering the professional market has become increasingly challenging. Opportunities are scarce and employer expectations are high. As part of our series on the issue of unemployment for young graduates on the continent, reporter Amaryllis Gule spoke to some who share their job hunting experiences and has this from Maputo, Mozambique. Amanda Ngome is a store manager and a digital content creator.
I hold a bachelor's degree in mathematics, yet I'm struggling to secure a job that aligns with my training. Job openings are posted in WhatsApp groups and on social media every day, and I have sent several applications. I have only received one callback, but unfortunately, that opportunity did not work out. Lately, young people join companies as interns in the hope of getting a job in the same company, and sometimes the internship ends and you leave without a job.
Ivania Kalitos is an advisor for a project helping young adults find jobs.
One of the biggest challenges I can identify is finding the balance between what companies ask for what young people have to offer. Many companies have requirements for job openings, but the majority of young people are not adequately prepared for that. For example, they often demand 5 years of experience from recent graduates who lack any professional work history.
The World Bank estimates that in 2022, 13% of those between the ages of 15 and 24 were unemployed in sub-Saharan Africa, but that can vary from more than 51% in South Africa to about 4% in Ivory Coast. You can see more of our series on employment on voaafrica.com. As part of our series this week on unemployment on the continent, we are also looking at some of the continent's economies. South Africa has a much smaller informal economy than many other African countries, a big reason why it has one of Africa's highest unemployment rates, hovering around 30% this past year. But Paritso Piraino, Professor of Education, Labour and Development in the Keoe School of Global Affairs at Indiana University of Notre Dame, tells VOA's Karen Van Dam several other factors have contributed to South Africa's extremely high jobless rate.
And that might contribute to a higher unemployment rate because informal work does count as work. However, it's not the only factor contributing to the extremely high unemployment rate. It's probably the highest in the continent. Unfortunately, the bad news is that it's a structural unemployment problem. It's not something that one could assume as being transitory for a given period of time, for some type of market cycle type of thing. There are some structural issues that have to do with both the demand and the supply side. On the demand side, there isn't just enough GDP growth and jobs created to attract especially young people in the workforce. And on the supply side, there is a few problems. I'll just mention two. It's a sort of skills mismatch, how much people are trained on different things that the economy needs. And there is a number of, again, structural problems that have to do with frictions in the labor market. Given the history of the country, a lot of people are really just live far from where the jobs are. And that changes the way people supply their labor, because it may not make sense to travel 2 hours to go to work.
What about other countries that have high jobless rates, and do the same kind of things apply to those countries, would you say? I mean, the continent is a huge continent, right? So there are probably other factors that go into this.
Yeah, in many respects, South Africa is quite unique in the continent. The history is different. The structure of the economy is different. In some of the other countries, the informal sector compensates a little bit on the unemployment side. And there is also, I would say, a larger subsistence agriculture type of sector that, again, counts as employment. So that would sort of lower the unemployment rate. On the other side, one thing that they do share is job creation and the effort these countries are making to sort of jump on the new types of jobs, right? Sort of high-tech jobs, IT jobs. And some countries are doing better than others, but it's still sort of lagging behind other parts of the world where they've been more successful in training their youth to take advantage of these new opportunities.
And speaking of that, with the youth, in your work, you've collaborated with government agencies and the World Bank to conduct evaluations of alternative services to ramp up youth employment and readiness. Tell us more about that, and how does it work?
Yeah, so one thing that, and I'm going to go back to South Africa now, because that's where the work you're referring to is based. One thing about South Africa that is particularly concerning is not just the high overall unemployment rate, is the youth unemployment rate. It's enormous. I don't even keep track of it anymore, unfortunately, because it's just above 50%. That means that you have an enormous amount of young people not being productive, right?
Yeah, which is never a good thing in any country.
Exactly. Also because it leads to a number of sort of social cohesion type of issues and anger and demands and political instability, all sorts of consequences that you know better than me. So one way to help youth enter the labor market is to work on what economists call market frictions, meaning that perhaps there is jobs, but the youth don't know about these jobs, or they don't know what they need to do to get those jobs. So among those market frictions, so information is one. I already mentioned distance. So the work I've done in the past with the University of Cape Town, where I used to work, plus the other organizations on the continent, including the World Bank in South Africa, is to look at ways to help youth navigate the crucial stage of entry into the labor market. And one way to do this is to help them signal their skills.
That was Patrizio Piraino, Professor of Education, Labor and Development at Indiana's University of Notre Dame. He also worked for years at the University of Cape Town, South Africa. Piraino was speaking with my colleague Carol Van Dam from South Bend, Indiana. Zimbabwe authorities say they are worried about rising crime, especially armed robberies, whose enforcement has led to law enforcement officers firing at and killing suspects. Colombo's Mavunga reports from Harare, where analysts say Zimbabwe's crime rate is increasing because poverty has left people in desperate conditions.
Peter Hapaore says he has seen conmen operating in his Harare, Zimbabwe neighborhood, pulling underhand deals and selling goods that turn out not to exist. But that's not all, he says. Apaore says both the crime rate and murder cases are increasing, so he's pleading with the police to work hard so that citizens are afraid to commit an offense. He says that police should be respected and must enforce laws diligently, and that it seems Zimbabwe is a lawless country with people murdering others freely. According to official figures, Zimbabwe's national crime rate in the third quarter of 2023 stood at 1,202 per 100,000 people, up slightly from the second quarter. The government reported 1,098 criminal acts leading to death or intending to cause death in that same period, compared to 958 in the third quarter of 2022. Recently, Zimbabwe's police force has expressed concern about a rise in armed robbery, some involving current or former members of the state security. In some cases, police killed suspects in shootouts or when suspects tried to flee. Albert Nguluwe, who heads Parliament's Committee for Defence, Home Affairs, War Veterans and Security Services, says police are sometimes outmanned.
With the limited resources, they are trying. Our crime rate can't compare with South Africa. We are still better off in Africa. So I think our police are trying their best, although you have some people who always blame them that they're heavy-handed. All what we want is a community that we want to have peace in this country.
Obed Muzembe, a criminologist at the Muzembe Law Chambers, says Zimbabwe's moribund economy and persistently high inflation are pushing many people toward crime so they can survive.
And then secondly, you are looking at the social fabric. You know, we have had a lot of migrations, people moving to South Africa, moving to the United Kingdom. It has created a society without parents. And as a result, young people are growing up without guidance and without mentorship, and they are bound to indulge in illegal activities.
Muzembe recommends that the government find a way to improve the economy and that the religious institutions and civic society do more to teach people good morals. Columbus Mavunga, VOA News, Harare.
A Kenyan government agency is helping students from low-income families access laboratories for science classes. The producer is making solar-powered mobile laboratories that are cheaper than building permanent facilities. Victoria Munga reports from Nairobi.
If you are not able to capture the clear...
Paul Githaiga is a teacher at Kenya's Utawala Academy. For much of his career as a science teacher, he made do with theoretical lessons. Githaiga says setting up laboratories was out of reach for the schools where he taught.
Most of the items that were there, they were only be found in books as diagrams, pictures, and a teacher may not be able even to demonstrate and to show that this is what is being taught in the course book.
But the introduction of this mobile laboratory stirred up science lessons and students' research projects. The labs are built from locally sourced materials like timber, are fitted with wheels for mobility, and have solar power for users in schools with limited or no power supply. Schools can purchase the labs for about $1,000. The manufacturer School Equipment Production Unit, or SEPU, says it's a distinct difference from the nearly $20,000 it costs to construct and equip a permanent laboratory. Students like John Mokaya are often shut out.
I got to understand many things, of which in grade 7 we used just to see from the books, but now we can have the real experience, how everything works, and due to this you can be great people in future.
SEPU says they're easily adaptable as they're made in Kenya. CEO Joel Mabonga told VOA they are designed with understanding of the local teacher, unlike imports.
It understands the dynamics of our education. It understands the teacher training of a Kenyan. Unlike if we got an innovation from outside, which we need to come and adopt it for the local environment. This is a solution that is born from within, and therefore it is going to spur more.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Peter Clote in Washington. For all the latest development on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer David Vandy and our engineer, the great Sidrack Franklin, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.